Rough or smooth, your call. A furry cup and saucer, an apple covered in prickles, skin like sandpaper, or a liquid smoothness when you expected, oh, something more. This week in the last half hour, a small journey into texture, the feeling of things. I'm Jonathan Green. Colin Bissett is a writer, broadcaster and design expert. Colin, texture brings extraordinary things to design the built environment.
Oh, it certainly does. And I mean, texture in design is always a choice. If anything that's been designed has, whoever's designed it or who's ever built it, the architect, whoever, has said, this is the texture I want. And texture works with colour and shape. And sometimes one is more dominant than the other. And sometimes texture is more dominant than another. But I think of something like the Sydney Opera House, and you look at that tremendous shape, but it's covered in tiles, a sort of creamy white tiles. Imagine if that was in raw concrete, or imagine if it was in cedar shingles or something. It would be an entirely different sort of building.
You would love it if it was in raw concrete.
I might. I don't think others would. a slap of paint on it, perhaps. But
corrugated iron.
Well, that would be very Australian.
This is the thing. Texture is so evocative. We say corrugated iron, we think the Australian outdoors. We say orange plastic, we think 1970.
Oh, it's definitely placemaking, and it's also of a time. I mean, I was thinking when I was travelling here, I was coming through the suburbs and I was seeing sort of these brick houses, knowing that often they've got brick interiors, and probably some of them still have shag pile carpets, and that whole sort of 70s sort of vibe. But we've actually gone back to that. I think that idea of, you know, 1960s Futurism that Robin Boyd talked about, we're back there again at the moment, where we have houses going up with lots of different textures, lots of stone walls, a bit of wood here and there, and, you know, all evoking something, you know, the Hamptons bit and then the sort of, you know, Federation sort of bit underneath and everything. Horrible, I think, a lot of the time. It's absolutely horrible because it's just too diverse. But interesting, it just shows that we love texture in buildings and in things.
What an appropriate introduction to Addie Smithers, chef and owner of De Fermier in Trentham in central Victoria. And Annie, there's so much in texture in food, not just in the eating, but in the making as well. I'm thinking of the process of making bread, of the feeling of dough.
I just want to sink into this and have this as my doona. And then you knock it back and beat it up and roll it around a bit and then let it have another go. And then you end up with this beautiful, crisp, golden creature that is completely different to what it started at or what it evolved through in the process of making it.
Tim Entwistle's director of the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria. These sounds, Tim, disassociated are rather strange.
It is. It's coming up behind me now. The gardens are full, of course, are very sensory. And they have colours, they have sounds, and the textures, though, are absolutely part of that experience. So you're looking at shiny green leaves, you might be looking at spiny cacti, you can have bark that's deep and furrowed or ribbony, and that experience of textures is really part of what you see when you go into a garden.
But it's doing stuff for the plants too. All those things you mentioned there, they are highly functional.
They are. Some are reflecting light, some are protecting leaves. What I find fascinating with a botanist is they have great minutiae of detail when they're talking about what a leaf covering is, you know, the hairs on a leaf, and they talk about crispate leaves, they talk about plumose and barbellate and all these different kinds of hairs that result in a coating on a leaf, and then you start to get arachnoid, so it's cobwebby, you get lanate, like a sheep. And you have hirsute, which is coarse and stiff. And I even brought a couple of leaves here, a sage, and I've got a blanket leaf, which are so soft.
Your blanket leaf is extraordinarily soft.
Just soft and just beautiful. But then at the other end of the spectrum, there's a sandpaper fig, which is very much like a piece of sandpaper.
And what does that do for the plant?
Well, it's interesting. In a lot of cases, it's protecting the plant maybe from being eaten. In some cases, it's... And a sandpaper fig has hairs. So these are very stiff, short hairs. We call them hispid, whereas the blanket leaf has is tomentose and soft, and that's helping it perhaps hold water and moisture and stop it losing too much of its the water from the plant on a hot day. So they've all got these little functions.
A word a day there from Tim Edwards.
Look, we go on forever. I must mention one more, flocos, I just love, which is hairs that are easily rubbed off and they're little flocks.
Sounds like me. When we thought texture here at Blueprint, we thought immediately of one particular substance. It was inevitable. We thought of Velcro. Mira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla took that a few steps further.
Have you ever thought about the history of Velcro? It takes a rare kind of optimism to find the goodness in a burr. While most of us might curse as we try to unpick that stubborn, prickly burr from our clothes, Swiss engineer Georges de Mestral, with the unwavering self-possession of a Swiss man, chose to remain calm. In 1941, returning from a hunting trip to the Alps with his dog, de Mestral noticed that his pants and the hair of his Irish pointer were covered in burrs from a burdock plant.
Oh, zut alors.
He returned to his alpine cottage, where Madame de Mestral was chairing a meeting of the local yodeling collective. Undeterred, de Mestral took to his laboratory, such as it was, and inspected the burrs under a microscope. He noticed hundreds of tiny hooks that caught on anything with a loop, like clothing, hair, and even animal fur. If only he could figure out how to reproduce the hooks and the loops, he knew he had a marketable product on his hands. With an entrepreneurial agility more characteristic of late capitalism sharing economy, the 1940s alpine culture, de Mestral, who patented his first invention at the age of 12, spent the next decade determined to refine and patent his invention. After much experimentation and frustration that likely strained an already tense domestic arrangement, de Mestral finally produced that synthetic burr. He named his invention Velcro, a portmanteau of the French words velours for velvet and crochet for hook. De Mestral expected a high demand immediately. Apparently, mid-20th century Europe was a removable, reusable, all-surface fastener desert. But in part due to its appearance, in part to its marketing as an oxymoronic zipperless zipper, it took a while to take hold. The history of Velcro sense is something of a parable of modern American triumph and defeat. In the 1960s, Velcro had its first major publicity coup when Apollo astronauts used it to secure food, objects, and equipment susceptible to the vagaries of zero gravity. Thereafter, Velcro became ubiquitous, appearing in hospitals, homes, on airplanes, and by the late 1980s on nearly every Reebok sneaker in the Western world. But like the military intervention itself, Velcro's use in the Iraq War was problematic, to say the least. Dust from the Afghan and Iraqi deserts and Velcro did not marry well. After many complaints from dissatisfied troops and a year-long investigation, the U.S. finally decided to ban the use of Velcro from military uniforms. But never fear. As long as human beings have the need for adhesion, fastening, and groundedness, the iconic Swiss invention will live on.
story of Velcro, as brought to you by Mira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla. And who knew, Tim Entwistle, that it would be plant-based?
Well, there are lots of plants, actually, that lead to inventions and textures. I was thinking as I was listening that there's the lotus, you know, that's the lotus leaf in the water, yes. Drips down and rolls off, and that's become a basis for paints that repel dirt and repel water.
I have here a leaf of a sandpaper fig. And listen to that. Eddie Smithers, in food texture, the relationship between texture and taste, how does that work in your mind?
Well, I think it operates in the structure of dishes. So, you know, when you eat something that has just a silken texture, it evolves, you know, it invokes certain memories and certain, you know, responses to it. But a complete dish will often have several, you know, a number of textures that work together so that you get slippery and you get crunchy and you get all of those textures in your mouth that actually help sort of shape the dish and how you think about it when you're eating it.
So as much as we might want to balance, you know, salt and sweet, we're also looking for those things around the texture of the food as well.
Yeah, there's sort of, you know, there's classic sort of Italian pasta dishes that will sprinkle with, you know, crisp breadcrumbs that give you that crunch amongst that slipperiness and things, so that you've got a point of difference as you're in your mouthfeel, as we refer to it as.
Colin Bissett, as I rub my fig for you.
Thank you.
Texture can lead us towards shapes in design. Texture can be a very formative influence in the designing process.
Formative? Well, I mean, it's something that we all have an emotional response to. And I was thinking of hipsters and how, you know, we're in this sort of hipster, sort of handmade sort of mode at the moment, where even, you know, men have beards, texture, we're into texture. Everything, even if we're using, like a lot of cafes have sort of copper piping everywhere and brick walls, raw brick walls, they have that sort of raw industrial look, but then they've got big knitted sweaters and knitted cushions everywhere. So we've got this sort of slight sort of Danish hygge sort of thing going on, this comfort thing, coziness. But also we're playing with double textures. So what Annie was saying about bringing in lots of different textures, lots of contrast, that's just what we use in design. So for instance, you might have a mobile phone, but it's got a soft feel button on it or something like that, something that just gives you a little sort of pleasure.
Well, you mentioned a mobile phone. I mean, in a world in which so many of our interrelations are smoothly digital, perhaps that's what, you know, makes us crave a lumpy knitted jumper or a face covered in hair.
Well, it's interesting to see how some people, a lot of mobile phones nowadays are just glass, so they're very smooth and they don't have any sort of real texture on them. But people put them in protective leather or, you know, all sorts of wooden covers, and people really sort of want that. We do have this emotional response to texture. It makes us feel at home. We like to soften things a lot of the time. Very few of us like everything to be very, very hard.
We are talking texture here on the last half hour on Blueprint for Living. Annie Smithers is a chef. And Annie, there must be some food textures that are just disgusting.
Yeah, there's a few that are disgusting to me, but it all comes down to personal taste.
Yes.
It really is. I find this the musillanimous texture of okra quite disgusting. It's not for me. And sort of in the same vein, I'm not terribly fond of the texture of tripe in my mouth or in my hands when I'm preparing it, because there's always, you know, with cooking and food, there's always those two states of, you know, the raw ingredient, which can be quite, you know, completely different to the cooked ingredient. So, you know, slippery bits of raw pork, and then you cook it forever and then you end up with this beautiful sort of firm sort of pork rillette. And it's that wonderful change in textures that fascinates me as a cook, of sort of, you know, how do, you know, how does this one thing go to the other? And it creates that sort of, you know, that sort of mystery and intrigue as well.
This is true with plants too, isn't it, Tim? I mean, as much as there are the lovely ones, the blanket leaves, there are some which are not so satisfying or pleasing to the touch or eye.
Yeah, and in some ways we seek those out. I mean, generally too, when you're designing, you're often creating a soft and tranquil kind of setting with lovely sort of warm textures. And but then at the other extreme, you get more modern designs. It's interesting just to look at the two botanic gardens in Melbourne, the one in Melbourne, which is a heritage, beautiful old garden with these sweeping lawns and lots of green and smooth and calm. You go to the Australian garden at Granbourne and you've got a modern design with some hard edges and you've got some pruned plants and a tighter sort of arrangement. And the feel and the textures are quite different.
But even more than that, I mean, yes, that's an issue of design, but it's an issue of continence. I mean, we have in a botanic garden a European textural sensibility. What we see around us in the Australian environment is very different.
We do. And that, I was thinking that too. The Australian plants are quite a different texture and colour. And there's sort of the glaucousy grey, which is really a texture. And we've actually got a grey garden in Melbourne Gardens, which is full of plants that are either soft and furry, like we've been fondling this morning, but also there are these glaucousy grey waxy leaves. And a lot of Australian plants are like that. They're sort of firm leaves, they're tough for the environment, and they have a whole different look about them to that sort of softer green feel. I remember when I worked a little while in London and people got so sick of the green, they actually look forward to winter. These were horticulturists. Mm. They couldn't wait till the leaves fell off the trees because they're just too much bright green, just too much.
Colin, in design, that responds to environment too. I mean, the textures that surround us and the things that work in that or within that or against that are really interesting and often texture-based.
Very much so. And I'm thinking of how in the early part of the 20th century, we had this sudden sort of appreciation of hygiene. And that's seen in sort of modernist architecture, which was seen as clean and bright and healthy. But also, I mean, 1918, there'd been the Spanish flu epidemic. So, you know, with vast amounts, millions and millions, 50 million people were killed by it. You know, incredible. So suddenly people had this awareness of bacteria and cleanliness. The slums were gradually sort of got rid of. And we went into this period of sort of non-texture, which we still sort of hold to in kitchens and in bathrooms. We like the idea of a smooth surface because, you know, infection can't cling on to it, we think.
But not just in those interior spaces. I mean, we loved bitumen for a while. We loved to concrete. And then we decided that we quite liked to cobble in a laneway and went back to that.
Well, everything changed. Everything seems to react to what's gone before. So you have in, say, 1950s, you get all this glass and, you know, shiny sort of glass and steel buildings. And then you get brutalism with all its concrete, which is sort of often was hammered. The surface of it was hammered. It looked very rough. It looked almost hewn out of rock. And then you've got high tech coming in, which is all sort of shiny chrome and stainless steel. And so constantly things are changing. I mean, it changes much faster, I think, in sort of interior design and in fashion. But in architecture, it also changes. We can look at a decade and we can say, oh, yes, well, you can see that where that building came from just because of its texture as much as anything else, you know, where our attraction is. I'm thinking even of the Pompidou Centre in 1973 or whatever in Paris. That was a building that had no facade, no texture, if you like, but its texture was made up of light because of all the pipes and everything. So, you know, there's lots of playing around with different textures, and that's on a cobbled plaza in front of it. Yes.
The kitchen, Annie Smithers, is a place with its own series of textures. As a built place, we have the hardness of steel. We have perhaps the comfort of a wooden bench.
Yeah, it is. It's you know, tiles, benches, bench tops, you know, and the domestic kitchen is now sort of, you know, really, you know, in the design, the hands of the design gods. But it's also, you know, that tactile thing of sort of the implements that you use, you know, the knives and the handles of the knives, the, you know, the sound of a knife being sharpened on a steel. So there's a constant interaction with, you know, the textural elements of the world when you're sitting, you know, quietly cooking family dinner.
Can you tell a chef's bent by the sort of kitchen they surround themselves in?
Oh, I think so. I think sort of, you know, with you know, there's kitchens that are, you know, full of pots and pans and old copper bits and pieces and little, you know, mementos of this and that and the other. And then there'll be really highly organized, sleek kitchens where they are highly functional. There's no mess, there's no waste, there's no, you know, almost no individual sort of, you know, imposition on the space. It really is just to cook food. So it comes down to the individual, I think.
Reflected, Tim, in the natural world. I mean, we feel our way through the world more than you think, I think.
You do. I mean, you when you're walking through it doesn't have to be a garden. It might be down a roadside or a path, and there are huge trees around you. There are all these sensations that you go through. And it's also interesting to think about how we control those. So I was thinking about pruning and the way we control that environment too. So there's that hand, and then coming back to our discussion around Australian plants, this sort of freedom and plants allowed to do what they like.
Although there's the sudden vogue now for things like topiary in Australian natives, you know, bending the textures of those plants to a different sort of textural pedigree.
Yeah, which I think is exciting and fun, and I'm really pleased people are doing that, because they're not putting plants into sort of categories. You can't prune that and you must prune this. But it's interesting though to look at the mainstream gardens these days, which tend to be of a certain cut, you know, greys and these deep greens and the hedges, the box hedges. That's a certain texture, which I'm a little tired of, I'd have to say. But then you have the Australian plants creeping into that, because they don't have to be wild and unruly and kind of looking like they're taking over the garden. You can actually control them a little bit. So I think that it comes together and it makes people feel a little bit safer with our Australian plants.
I like what you said before, Colin, about light providing its own sort of sense of texture. I mean, just the play of things on things that gives us
so
that
important,
textural feeling.
Isn't it? I mean, this is what we do. We do textures with screens and things like that. We walk into, this is what texture is all about. How whether a room has a carpet or it has tiles, I mean, or a wooden floor, that changes, it changes the acoustic and it changes the look and it changes our response to it. So, you know, here I am sitting in a studio with fabric up the walls and carpet, you know, all to absorb the sand, you know, but it's a rather strange space, really.
And yet functional in its way.
Well, it's not unlike nightclubs in the 1970s that had carpet on the ceiling. You know?
Well, it's also, I was thinking in gardens, one of the things that's really important is whether you have a concrete path or you have a gravel and you're crunching, or sand, and those, it's entirely
different. Like Japanese gardens, that sort of difference. You know, you were talking about topiary, and then you've got sort of grasses, soft grasses, and then gravel and rocks,
or
you know.
Possibly, Annie, the path to an eating room.
Well, indeed, or to a garden to grow food.
Equally significant. We look, thanks to all our participants, we have been discussing the wonderful and profoundly touchable world of texture here in the last half hour. Colin Bissett joined you, writer, broadcaster, design expert, Annie Smithers, chef and owner of De Fermier in Trentham, and Tim Entwistle, director of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne. Producers Amira Adligillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production by Ari Gross. I'm Jonathan Green, and this is a Sandpaper Fig.